Near Kashyyyk, Wookiee homeworld, aboard the Anakin Solo.
How ironic it seemed to Jason that he should confront his betrayers here, in the home system of a species famed for its honor. How sad that he must battle his own blood above Kashyyyk, where loyalty counted for more than life itself. Even after all that had happened, he still loved his family, still cherished them. It was their courage that had instilled in him the strength to do what he must soon do, their example that had taught him to serve above all else. He only wished there were some way to bring them back, so all the Solos and Skywalkers could be on the same side again, fighting not each other, but the injustice that had always seemed about to tear the galaxy apart. But there was no way. Even were Jason to convince them of their mistake, he could not absolve them of what they had done, could not pardon their treason against the Alliance. That was the burden and the fate of Darth Kydus, to deliver justice wherever it was deserved, and he dared not shirk his duty. Sith lords could not turn a blind eye to the crimes of their own relatives. Down that path lay corruption and selfishness, the belief that he was the master of the galaxy and not its servant. A squadron of new Owul interceptors appeared in the bridge viewport, still so distant that only the curving stripes of their paired efflux tails were visible against Kashyyyk's emerald face. The pride of an innovative new shipyard named Kashikorp, the Owuls had been designed to serve the Galactic Alliance as heavy starfighters. Like the Wookiees who piloted them, they were tough, fast, and ferocious.
"What a dismal showing," Ben said.
He was standing with Kydus and Commander Twizzle on the primary flight deck, watching 50-odd crew beings calmly coordinate the Anakin Solo's combat preparations.
"If those Owuls are all they have ready, there won't be a fight. Even Wookiees aren't that crazy."
"Wookiees are resolute, not crazy," Kydus replied. Ben had been trying to talk him out of attacking Kashyyyk since the Anakin Solo's escape from the Battle of Kuat. It made Kydus worry that his young cousin lacked the ruthlessness to carry out his plan of vengeance, that Lumaya might have been right about the boy, being too weak to be a Sith apprentice. "And they will fight, Ben. Never confuse hope with expectation."
"I wasn't," Ben insisted. "But we need the Kashyyyk fleet, Jason. If there's any way to take it without a fight..."
"There isn't," Kydus interrupted. "And I'd like you to call me Colonel, not Jason." Ben looked surprised, but not hurt.
"Okay, Colonel."
"Thank you." Kydus' appreciation was sincere. He didn't mind Ben calling him by his first name, but it was starting to feel wrong to be addressed by his old moniker. Jason Solo was gone. "And I didn't say we wouldn't give the Wookiees a chance to avoid a fight, only that they won't take it."
"They certainly don't seem inclined," Commander Twizzle said from Kydus' other side. "Those Owuls are threatening to open fire if we don't stop and explain ourselves."
Kydus glanced at the tactical holo display and smiled. With the entire Fifth Fleet spread across space behind the Anakin Solo, the Owuls were outnumbered 2-1 by capital ships alone. "You do have to respect their courage," he said. "Very well, Commander. Tell them we'll respect their orders."
"You intend to comply?" Twizzle asked, surprised.
"Of course," Kydus said. "Bring the Anakin Solo to a dead stop, and have Admiral Atoko form the fleet around us." Twizzle frowned.
"Sir, Lieutenant Skywalker may have a point. If we move now, we may capture their assault fleet intact. It's still trying to free itself of the tenders, and their orbital guard is no match for the Fifth Fleet."
"Commander, I hope you're not advocating an unprovoked attack on a current member world of the Galactic Alliance," Kydus said. "As far as we know, all the Wookiees have done is listen to the Jedi deserters. They haven't betrayed us yet."
"So you're not going to attack?"
Ben sounded more confused than he did relieved.
"Then why did we pull the Fifth Fleet out of the core?"
"To give the Wookiees an opportunity to do the right thing." Kydus turned to Twizzle, who was looking increasingly perplexed and unhappy. "You have your orders, Commander. Tell the Owuls we've come for the prisoners, and we'll depart as soon as we have them." Twizzle's eyes hardened in disapproval, but he nodded and stepped over to his communications officer's station. Ben wasn't so easily persuaded.
This is only going to make things worse, Colonel. They're not going to turn Uncle Han and Aunt Leia over to you.
Of course not. They're Wookiees, Kytus said. They're too stubborn. But when they refuse, we'll have justification to proceed.
After their fleet is deployed?
Ben's tone was growing more desperate, but he was hiding his presence from the Force, a sign that he was finally gathering himself to strike.
We'll never capture it then. They'll fight until the last vessel is slagged.
True. Kytus knew that if Ben tried to kill him now, the youth would be acting for noble reasons, trying to save thousands of lives by ending one. Reasons didn't matter, though. Actions did. The mere attempt would be the catalyst that moved Ben to the next stage. But we didn't come here to capture the Kashyyyk fleet. Ben contemplated this a moment, then asked,
You're serious about taking the prisoners back?
Of course not, Kytus said. We're here because this is what's going to keep the Confederation from capturing Kuat and moving on to Coruscant. Ben fell silent again, staring out the bridge viewport where the Ouls had swelled into gleaming dots with sickle-shaped bows. Finally, he gave up and shook his head.
I don't get it.
Good. Kytus stepped over to join Twizzle at the communications station, presenting his back to Ben and inviting the youth to take his vengeance. Neither will the Confederation. When no attack came, Kytus began to wonder if he had misjudged his young cousin. Ben still believed him to be Mara's killer. That was obvious by how carefully he kept his feelings masked. So why wouldn't he attack? 2 steps later, Kytus found himself next to Twizzle behind the communications officer, listening to the voice of the Wookiee squadron commander and feeling betrayed by his cousin's failure. The comm officer, a Bith female with ebony eyes as large as Kytus's palms, was listening to a translation in a comlink earpiece.
Colonel Solo, they're saying they don't have any...
It's not necessary to translate. I've understood Shriwook since I was 5. Kytus leaned over her shoulder and keyed the mic. We're here for Han and Leia Solo and the Jedi deserters. If you're having trouble with the Jedi deserters, we're prepared to assist. That's why we brought a fleet. The squadron leader rumbled a denial, claiming the Solos had escaped and the Jedi had not even come to Kashyyyk. Our information is solid, Kytus said. If you're saying the Solos are no longer your prisoners, then Kashyyyk has betrayed the Alliance, or the Jedi are holding the planet hostage. Either way, we'll be forced to attack. The Wookiee replied that he would check with his superiors, and the channel fell silent. As Kytus and the others waited for a reply, the Anakin Solo continued to decelerate. The 5th Fleet began to form up around her, deploying starfighter pickets and positioning its aging star destroyers with overlapping fields of fire. The Ouul squadron continued to approach, swelling from sickle-nosed dots into fork-prowed wedges. Finally, the Wookiee's voice came over the speaker again, insisting the colonel had been misinformed. No Solos were being held in Kashyyyk, and they had no problem with the Jedi deserters. That's what I like about you Wookiees, Kytus replied. You never hide where you stand. He had barely deactivated the mic before Twizzle began to issue orders, preparing to resume the advance. That won't be necessary, Commander, Kytus said. The planet is already within range of the Anakin Solo's long-range turbo lasers, is it not? Twizzle's bushy brows dropped so low that they nearly covered his eyes. Of course, but the Kashyyyk fleet is... Unimportant. Kytus faced Twizzle, presenting his back to Ben again. If the order he was about to give did not prompt his cousin to attack, then nothing would. Have the long-range batteries open fire. Twizzle's face went slack with confusion. On the Ouls? On the planet? As Kytus spoke, he was careful to keep his hand away from his lightsaber. He wanted to give his cousin every chance to attack. If Ben did not strike soon, he would have to be eliminated as unworthy. Have them direct their fire to the same target area. The objective is to create a firestorm. Kytus' command was greeted by utter silence, and he could feel the Force reverberating with the shock of the officers and crew who had overheard the command. Only Ben failed to seem surprised, though perhaps it was because he was still hiding his presence from the Force. Jason continued to face Twizzle, giving the youth plenty of time to strike. After a couple of moments, Twizzle finally seemed able to respond. You want to burn the Roshirs?
Precisely, Kytus said. The entire world forest, if we can. Twizzle's expression changed from stunned to condemning.
But that's just madness! It won't accomplish anything!
That's not your conclusion to reach, Commander, Kytus replied. However, just this once, I will explain myself to you.
I'd appreciate that, Colonel.
Very well. You were at the Battle of Kuat, so you know how evenly matched our militaries are. Twizzle nodded.
The Confederation will have to break off soon, he said. They can't match the Alliance in a war of attrition.
And we can't afford one, Kytus countered. We're already too weak to defend all the worlds under our protection, and the Confederation knows it. So you're wrong. They're not going to withdraw. They're going to keep fighting and hope we'll withdraw, which we can't do. It would leave a clear lane all the way to Coruscant.
So we're in a stalemate, Ben said,
disappointing Kytus by stepping toward him, not to attack, but to join the conversation.
How's burning Kashyyyk going to change that?
Unable to hide his frustration, Kytus whirled on the boy.
Think, Ben. What do we both need to break the stalemate? What are we losing here and the Confederation gaining?
Ben recoiled from the venom in Kytus' voice, but he answered quickly.
Allies. Correct.
Kytus placed his hand on Ben's shoulder, but he was so angry he had to stop himself from drawing back and striking the youth.
And if the Confederation hopes to make an ally of the Wookiees, what must they do?
Twizzle's eyes lit with angry comprehension.
Come to Kashyyyk's defense.
Which means they have to abandon their drive on Coruscant,
Ben finished.
And burning the forest is going to provoke a lot more public outrage than just capturing the Kashyyyk assault fleet. If the Confederation doesn't help the Wookiees, they're going to have trouble recruiting more worlds. It'll look like they don't care about anyone but themselves.
Right again, Kytus said.
But who'll want to join us? Twizzle demanded. We're going to look like monsters.
Kytus smiled.
Exactly, Commander. Worlds will tremble at the thought of deserting us. If we're willing to burn the Kashyyyk Forest as punishment, who knows what we might do to them?
Twizzle's mouth dropped in horror, and he stared at Kytus without saying anything.
I have grown weary of waiting, Commander, Kytus said. Will you relay my order now, or do I need to appoint a new commander?
The threat was enough to shake Twizzle out of his daze.
That won't be necessary, Colonel. I see no military reason to disregard your orders. Your rationale seems as sound as it does chilling.
Kytus dipped his chin in mock gratitude. I'm glad you approve, Commander. The blood drained from Twizzle's face, and he turned to relay the order. Kytus glanced over and found Ben's expression as unreadable as his force presence. The order to burn Kashyyyk had to be eating the boy up inside, but even that wasn't enough to make him strike. Kytus returned to the tactical holo display and didn't bother giving Ben another chance. If setting the Roshirs ablaze didn't make the boy act, nothing would.
This is going to drive them crazy, Ben said,
sticking as close to Kytus as he had years earlier, when he was just a child, starting to overcome his fear of the Force.
Where do you want me?
At my side will be fine. It was a struggle for Kytus to keep the sadness out of his voice. It pained him to think of what he would soon have to do, but there was no avoiding it. Even if Ben didn't have the courage to strike today, one day he would, and under less controlled circumstances. I'll need you close when the fighting starts, Kytus said. We'll have to keep an eye out for stealth X's.
Yeah,
Ben said.
The plasma will really splash the shields when the Anakin Solo opens fire.
The viewport tinting dimmed as four ribbons of brilliance flashed from the tip of the Anakin Solo's bow and streaked toward the dark ovoid of the planet's nightside. A wave of shock and fear rippled through the Force from the direction of the Owul squadron, then quickly changed to confusion as the Wookiees realized the attack had not been directed at them. When the turbolaser bolts burned through Kashyyyk's atmosphere and blossomed into a pinpoint of scarlet flame, the confusion changed to disbelief. The batteries flashed again, striking in the same place and enlarging the pinpoint into a flickering red speck. The disbelief changed to rage. Then, as the turbolasers flashed a third time, to seething resolve. Kaida saw the O'Wools dip their prows toward the Anakin Solo's bow, then lost sight of them when the turbolasers fired again. Twizzle stepped to the holo display, dutifully placing himself at Kaida's side, opposite Ben, despite the fear and revulsion he was radiating into the Force.
"Assessment is estimating a forest fire half a kilometer square and growing," he reported. "I've instructed them to change the target areas every time they reach a self-perpetuating threshold."
"Well done," Kaidas replied.
"We don't want the Wookiees undoing our hard work."
"Maybe it would be smart to target a city or two," Ben said. "That way we can keep their fire suppression teams busy trying to save populated areas."
Twizzle's jaw fell, and he looked past Kaidas at Ben with a look of loathing and incredulity, as though he could not quite believe the thoughts that sprouted in teenage minds.
"Excellent idea, Lieutenant."
Kaidas turned to Twizzle. "Pass it along to Fire Control, Commander."
"As you wish."
Twizzle started to turn away, then stopped, scowled at the tactical display, and looked at an ensign standing on the opposite side of the holopad.
"What happened to the O'Wools?"
"I think they got in the way of a turbo laser strike, sir,"
sang the ensign, a waist-high bim female with floppy ears and blonde fur.
"They were there before the last strike, then they were just gone."
Kaidas' heart rose into his throat. He could still feel the Wookiee's rage burning in the Force. "That's not what happened," he said.
"They're still there. I sense them coming."
Twizzle returned to Kaidas' side and slapped the activation switch of a ship-wide comm.
"Incoming starfighters! Arm the cluster bombs and activate the autocannons! All ship defense systems, fire at will!"
The BIM aide laid her ears out flat.
"I don't understand. Do O'Wools have stealth?"
"No," Kaidas interrupted. "They're riding the stripe."
The BIM looked more confused than ever.
"Riding the..." "Using our own turbo laser strikes for cover," Ben explained. "It's an old Jedi trick. The flash static prevents our sensors from locating them. And since our own fighters have to keep clear of the firing lane..."
"Only Jedi could fly like that,"
Twizzle interrupted, having finished with his ship-wide alert.
"If we're facing Jedi, we're not."
Just to be certain, Kaidas concentrated his Force awareness on the presence of the O'Wool pilots.
"Unless one of those Wookiees is..."
Kaidas let the thought trail off and began to concentrate on individual pilots, searching for one in particular. One he would certainly recognize. And then he found it. A Force-sensitive presence he had known since childhood.
"Of course!"
Kaidas' exclamation of recognition was reflected by an explosion of rage and bewilderment in the Force, and he could almost hear Lobaka roaring in the cockpit of his O'Wool, demanding to know how his old classmate could betray their friendship so terribly. And for a moment, Kaidas became Jason once again, filled with sorrow for what he had become, yet still knowing how necessary it all was. It was the only way to bring order to a galaxy that fed on strife and war. The only way to create a home where his daughter and daughters of all his allies and enemies would one day be able to grow up in peace and security. Jason opened himself to the Force and reached out to Loey, inviting his old friend to join a battle meld of a different sort, one filled with regret and apology. Loey responded, again wanting to know why, again trying to impress on Jason that he did not have to do this, that perhaps they could still find a way to be friends. That was when Jason located his old classmate in the Force and felt him coming up under the Anakin Solo's bow. He also felt the presences of non-Jedi Wookiee pilots blinking out as the Star Destroyer's cluster bombs and autocannons did their work. And for an instant, he sensed the weight of a shadow bomb in Lobaka's Force grasp. "Sorry," Jason thought. And then he was Kaidas again, breaking the meld so he could turn to warn Twizzle.
"It's Lobaka, coming up!"
Kaidas did not feel what came next, not really. He simply realized a bolt of danger sense was sizzling down his spine and whirled away from the holo display. Then felt the heat of a lightsaber brush across his ribs as Ben's blade snapped to life and buried itself in the torso of Commander Twizzle. Suddenly, the air was filled with the stench of scorched flesh, both Kaidas's and Twizzle's, and Ben was gasping in shock and guilt and still attacking despite it all, slicing Twizzle's torso half off as he swung his blade back toward Kaidas, stepping in close to be certain of the kill. It might have been Lobaka's shadow bomb or Kaidas' own swift reflexes that saved his life. He doubted that either he or anyone else would ever know. The Anakin Solo simply bucked beneath his feet. Then he saw Ben's lightsaber sweep past his face and slam down hard and found himself lying on the deck with everyone else. His vision narrowed and his ears rang. How terribly he had underestimated his young cousin. How patiently Ben had bided his time, willing to sacrifice Kashyyyk's forest, Commander Twizzle, even his own life, all to make certain he killed Kydus. Maybe there was hope for the boy after all. With no time to snatch his own weapon off his belt, Kydus lashed out, loosing a bolt of force lightning that sent Ben tumbling across the floor in a smoking, convulsing heap. He summoned the boy's lightsaber to hand, then sprang to his feet amid the wreckage that, until a moment ago, had been the Anakin Solo's flight deck. Corpses lay strewn everywhere, especially toward the front of the cabin, where Lobaka's shadow bomb had breached the viewport. Or so he assumed from the crushed body parts lying at the base of the lowered blast curtain. Kydus stepped over to Ben. The youth was already starting to recover from the force lightning, straightening his curled limbs and taking short gasps of air. Ignoring the Bim ensign who reached out for help, Kydus squatted next to his young cousin and nodded in approval. Not bad. He had to use the force to make himself heard over the blaring damage alarms and the screams of the wounded. Artfully done, even. Ben's eyes rolled toward Kydus, filled with anger and hate.
Just finish it!
Finish it? Kydus deactivated the lightsaber and tucked it into his belt, then used the force to pull the boy to his feet. Ben, we're just getting started.
Rook Ro'o'ro, capital of Kashyyyk.
The smoke in Military Hangar 15 hung gray and gritty, seeping between floor panels and door seams, and billowing through the entrance every time the barrier field was lowered. Wookiees with singed fur and patches of blistered flesh were lopping back and forth, rushing to ready the Jedi stealth X's before the hangar went up in flames. Leia was alarmed by how quickly the conflagration was spreading across Rook Ro'o'ro, but she was hardly surprised. Even in a damp climate like Kashyyyk, fires of a certain size were self-feeding monsters, drying the surrounding forest so they could devour it. And Jason, blast him, was making sure every fire reached the necessary size.
"Burning the Roshiers is bad enough,"
Han said, stepping off the Falcon's ramp beside her.
"But targeting the cities?"
He stifled a cough.
"We should have dropped that kid out the med center window the day he was born."
The bitterness in Han's voice made Leia's heart ache.
"Han, please."
Her eyes began to water, but she convinced herself it was the smoke to blame.
"You don't mean that."
"Oh, no?"
Han retorted.
"Look around, sweetheart. These beings used to respect me."
Leia didn't bother doing as he suggested. It was impossible to miss the furtive looks being cast their way, or for a Jedi not to feel the mix of anger and pity permeating the Force.
"I'm certain they'll forgive you for not doing a better job with Jason,"
C-3PO said, clunking down the boarding ramp behind them.
"Wookiees tend to be very understanding about difficult children."
"It's been a long time since Jason was a child, 3PO. Leia peered into the smoke, searching for her brother, and said to Han, "And if we had dropped him out a window, the galaxy would belong to the Yuuzhan Vong right now. Whatever Jason has become, he was a hero once. Jason Solo saved the galaxy."
"Yeah? Well, there is no Jason Solo now."
Han started across the hangar floor toward a quiet corner where Luke and the council members were barely visible through the smoke, gathered in a tight group plotting strategy.
"Jason Solo is dead. My son wouldn't do this."
"Where have I heard that before?"
Leia started after him, shaking her head at his customary hyperbole.
"Let me think. We were on the Falcon, inbound toward Corellia, and we just learned what he'd done to Aelin."
Leia stopped in her tracks, letting the sentence trail off. Han wasn't exaggerating, she realized. He was right. After what had happened to Jason as a prisoner of the Yuuzhan Vong, their son might have been capable of torturing Aelin Haber to death. But he would never have been capable of setting an entire planet ablaze. Not the compassionate child who used to sneak pets into his room in the Jedi Academy on Yavin 4. And certainly not the Jedi Knight who had shown the galaxy how to make peace with the species that didn't even have a word for it. That Jason was dead. Jason Solo is dead.
It only took about 7 steps for Han to realize Leia wasn't following.
Ah, Stang, he said, marching back. Don't be mad. I didn't mean it like that.
Leia tried to answer, but all that came out was a garbled croak. Han frowned.
What's wrong? Has something happened to Jaina?
No, Leia managed. She wanted to wail, to tear at her hair and sink into catalepsy, but she could not. Her grief seemed trapped inside, a fuming reservoir of rage and pain that would keep burning her up until it finally exploded.
Jaina's... she's fine. It's Jason.
Jason?
Han's scowl returned. Then he glanced heavenward as if to suggest that he knew his greatest disappointment was still up there.
I don't get it. Are you saying Loey got him?
Leia shook her head.
No, Han. I'm saying you're right. There's nothing left to get.
Han looked more confused than ever. But before she could explain, her brother arrived with Saba and the other masters and came straight to her side. Luke's lips tightened in the way they always did when he steeled himself to make a difficult statement, and he made a point of meeting Han's gaze. I'm sorry, but you're not in a good frame of mind to fight. He glanced at Leia, then added, either of you. Han's jaw dropped, his expression changing from disbelief to anger to determination.
Just try to stop us, he said. Jason's our son. That makes him our problem.
Master Skywalker is right, Han, Kip said. You're too angry to fight. If you could feel yourself in the Force.
I don't need the Force to tell me how angry I am, Han said. And I've got a criffing good reason.
And they fell to arguing. Han insisting that nobody was going after Jason without him. Luke and the Masters using the weakest of all weapons against his stubbornness, logic, to argue otherwise. Leia did not join in. While she knew her brother and the others were right, she also knew it would be easier to hit escape velocity off a black hole than to fight Han on this. By the time Leia returned her attention to the argument, Tahiri had arrived to join in.
Even if the Falcon did have stealth technology, Tahiri was telling Han, in your frame of mind, it's a suicide run.
I know,
Han shot back.
I've made lots of them.
Han, they're right.
Leia took his arm and squeezed hard, interrupting his rant long enough to make her point.
Getting ourselves killed isn't going to stop Jason or help Kashyyyk.
Han scowled down at her.
Yeah, so?
So I don't know about you, but I'm not big on meaningless death, she said. I'd rather do something that actually has a chance of saving some of these Roshiers. Like what?
To Leia's surprise, it was Tahiri who asked this.
If you think you can fool us by saying one thing and doing another, try again.
Jedi Vela,
Saba admonished.
Princess Leia would do no such thing. She is a Jedi Knight, the same as you.
She's also married to Han Solo,
Tahiri retorted.
And that's been one of his favorite tactics since before you were hatched. I want to know what she's got in mind.
Not that. Leia kept her attention focused on Han. We're not ready for the scrap heap yet, Flyboy. What do you say we do something useful? Han's arm finally began to relax.
You've got a plan? You're not just saying that?
Leia smiled.
It's a real beauty.
She started to pull him back toward the Falcon.
Trust me.
Corriban, Horacet System, homeworld of the Sith.
This can't be the place.
Alima was staring out through a transparent band of ship's hull, studying a dusty wreck of a spaceport. Half the berth space was occupied by rusting transports, and the other half was so saturated with spilled service fluids that the slightest spark might send the whole place up in a toxic fireball. A mixed-species ground crew of slovenly technicians was squatting outside the portmaster's office, rolling fist-sized knuckle bones and making a point of ignoring her.
You made a mistake,
she said to Ship. Ship did not think so. This was where the navigation string had led. If the broken one had not wanted to go to Korriban, the mistake was hers.
This is Korriban?
Alima was horrified and confused. Every Jedi student read about Korriban and its dark past, especially the Valley of the Dark Lords, where the spirits of ancient Sith masters were said to still linger. But there was no mention of it being a modern Sith stronghold. In fact, Luke seemed mostly to want to ignore the place, banning all navigation data regarding it from the Jedi computers, and asking the Galactic Alliance to do the same. Looking out at the dilapidated spaceport, Alima could not imagine why he'd bothered.
"Are you sure this was the only population center?"
Alima asked.
"There can't be Sith here."
Ship had detected no other concentration of habitations anywhere on the planet. It was not lost on Alima that it said nothing about the Sith. Alima went to the spot where Ship usually extruded a boarding ramp for her.
"We have come all this way,"
she said, assuming a casual tone.
"It will not hurt us to have a look."
The hull remained solid, and Ship seemed to feel vaguely insulted that she thought it could be fooled so easily.
"We are not trying to fool you,"
Alima said.
"We only wish to ask the ground crew where we are, to prove you made a navigation mistake."
A section of the hull melted open and shaped itself into a ramp. Alima descended the ramp and crossed the grime-slickened floor to the ground crew. They looked more shabby than tough. With holes in their overalls, gaunt faces suggested they were not eating well. The Bothan's fur was matted close to his body. The Barabel's scales were too caked with mold to lie flat, and the human skin was pocked with red sores.
"Hello, boys. We know you're busy, but maybe you can help a girl out."
The Bothan bared his fangs in that predatory smile males often got when they realized they were being invited to make an advance.
"For a bent girl like you, maybe we can find some time," he said. "What do you need?"
Alima returned his smile with one just as predatory.
"Just an answer," she said. "And maybe a map to your place."
The human stood and stepped a little too close, considering how he smelled.
"I've got answers too."
Alima cocked her brow.
"We'll bet you do."
The Barabel hissed, then sank onto his haunches to wait for the game to resume. Alima ignored him and asked,
"So where do we find the Sith?"
The change in the Bothan's expression was so subtle that Alima barely noticed, and the human did a credible job of looking confused. Their force presences were another matter, becoming drawn and so frightened that Alima thought they might attack.
"You don't."
The Bothan stood and motioned to the others.
"Come on, you two. We've got work to..."
"What about our answer?"
Alima's tone was flirtatious, but the strength with which she force-grabbed him was not.
"We just hate being disappointed."
The human crashed into his taskmaster's back and appeared confused for a moment. Then he heard the Bothan wheezing for breath and looked back to Alima in dread.
The Sith are dead, have been for centuries.
"Come now."
Alima put her hand under the man's chin and drew his face close to hers.
"You can't lie to a Jedi."
She crushed his jaw with a force squeeze and sent him stumbling back into the portmaster's office, then returned her attention to the Bothan.
"We will ask nicely one more time. Where are the Sith?"
"Don't make a difference how you ask,"
the Bothan answered, rather bravely, Alima thought.
"Whatever you do to us..."
"Us,"
the Barabel hissed.
"Rakik is not going to hide them. If one tail wants to die, it is fine with him."
Alima turned to the Barabel.
"Thank you. Where do I find the Sith?"
"The Valley of the Dark Lords,"
Rakik said.
"Go to the valley mouth. You will find their cloister."
The Bothan groaned miserably.
"Rakik, if you didn't just get us all killed, you're fired."
Rakik glanced at the Bothan, then added,
"You are going to need transport. Yastua has a working swoop."
10 minutes later, Alima was streaking on Yastua's swoop toward a notched mountain that Rakik had pointed to as her destination. The more she saw of Korriban's parched terrain, the more she doubted that she had found the right place. Could this really be the source of the great Sith conspiracy that Lumaya had hinted at? And yet the closer Alima drew to her destination, the murkier the light grew, and the harder she found it to continue on. At last, she came to a dark canyon, cutting deep into the mountain at which Rakik had pointed her. Until a few minutes earlier, the mountain had looked like nothing more than a high peak. But now, she saw that it was an entire massif, a gigantic upthrusting of the planetary crust, where the world itself seemed to have quaked with the coming of the Sith. And standing at the mouth of this grim canyon was the ancient cloister Rakik had promised, a complex of domed towers enclosed behind a high stone wall. Clinging to the wall exterior were remnants of a blue tile facade, each patch depicting an eye or claw or fang. Alima stopped and dismounted, turning her back to the cloister so she could take the precaution of slipping a defensive dart into the palm of her crippled hand. Then she went to the gate, a 4-meter slab of durasteel flanked with red scales of corrosion, and stood for nearly a minute without announcing herself. Finally, the gate slowly squealed open to reveal a tall Togorian. His face had been shaved naked to display his tattoo striping, which ran along the top of his thick snout, then flared into concentric circles around his dark eyes and upright ears. Alima smiled and ran her eyes up and down his imposing, powerfully built form.
At last, just what we were looking for.
The Togorian lashed out so fast that Alima barely realized his hand had moved, but she felt his claws sinking into the back of her good arm. Without speaking, he pulled her inside and dragged her through a murky archway. A dozen steps later, they entered a large courtyard surrounded by dark balconies and gloom-filled doorways, and he threw her down on a floor of black cobblestones.
Tell us how you found us, Jedi, and your death will be swift.
He was pinning her down with the Force, his strength so obvious and great that Alima didn't even try to fight.
Hesitate, and your pain will amuse us every day for a year.
We did not come here for a swift death, and we will amuse you for however long you like.
The Togorian's lip curled. Choosing to ignore the reaction, she had a vial of flesh-eating bacteria from Tanupe that she could use to right the balance later. Alima smiled back at him.
But we will be happy to explain how we found you.
Then I will be happy to let you live until you have done so. After that, we shall see.
Fair enough,
Alima said.
We followed the navigation string on a data chip.
And where did you acquire this data chip?
The Togorian demanded.
Not so fast,
Alima said.
We have questions too.
The Togorian placed a foot on her ribs and began to step down, squeezing her chest so ferociously that she could no longer breathe. She used the Force to bring up her crippled arm, driving the dart hidden in her hand into the unarmored flesh behind his knee. The foot came off her chest immediately, and the Togorian leapt back. His lightsaber snap hissed to life, but he did not make the mistake of releasing his Force grasp on Alima.
What was that?
He demanded.
A warning,
Alima replied. This drew a hissing snicker from the courtyard balcony, and a raspy female voice said,
The Skeeto has a bite. I hope you haven't killed poor Morto. He was only following instructions.
Alima glanced over at the Togorian, who, aside from the hateful glare he was casting her way, was showing no sign of the fiery pain that she knew must be burning up his leg.
He will live,
she said,
provided he lets me up. Very well.
The woman must have nodded to the Togorian, Morto, because Alima found herself able to move.
I see no harm in trading questions, Jedi. You are never going to leave here alive.
Alima breathed a sigh of relief and rose, then reached into a pocket and withdrew one of the vials she had brought back from Tanupe. She examined the code she had scratched onto the top to make sure it was the correct one, then tossed it to Morto.
Rub that onto the wound. All of it.
A wave of relief rolled through the Force as Morto caught the vial. Then he knelt and began to unbuckle his leg armor. Alima waited until he began to rub in the Tanupian bacteria, then smiled to herself. balance. She turned toward the female voice and was surprised to discover a whole row of cloaked figures standing on the balcony. Save for variations in body size and structure, they all appeared similar to the figures she had seen on Lumaya's data chip, wearing dark cloaks with the hoods pulled forward to conceal their faces.
"Your question?"
The voice was low and harsh and masculine, and it came from a figure in the center of the rear balcony, one with pale white eyes, barely visible beneath the hood.
"And no tricks, Jedi. We Sith have never been known for our patience."
Alima ran her gaze along the balcony railings.
"How can you all be Sith?"
she asked.
"We were taught there are never more than two, a master and an apprentice."
"You are taught the old ways," the voice said. "We are only one Sith now."
Alima had counted more than 30, but it did not serve her purpose to call the man on his obvious lie. She reached inside her cloak for Lumaya's data chip, then lifted her brow when the gesture caused 30 lightsabers to ignite in the blink of an eye.
"Flattering, but we are not that dangerous."
She displayed the data chip she had taken from Lumaya's habitat.
"This is the data chip we..."
Before she could finish, the chip was torn from her hand and floated up to the Sith with the white eyes. He examined it without bothering to insert it into any sort of data reader, then nodded to the others.
"It's the one."
He looked back to Alima.
"Where did you find it?"
"The same place I came by my Sith ship,"
Alima said, confident they already had someone in the spaceport watching ship, if not actually flying it here.
"I inherited it from my master, Lumaya."
The white eyes flared with suspicion.
"You are very free with your answers. That is two for one question."
Alima shrugged.
"We have no reason to believe you will cheat us. What would be the point when you are going to kill us anyway?"
"Indeed," said White Eyes. "Your question."
"We cannot imagine you have a connection to the holonet in this hovel, but we assume you are aware of Mara Skywalker's death."
"We have our avenues of information, yes,"
White Eyes replied.
"I thought as much. Are you aware that I killed her?"
No sound disturbed the courtyard's silence, but the darkness rippled with equal parts surprise and disbelief.
"You?"
White Eyes asked. Alima nodded.
"Us?"
She could feel White Eyes and the others examining her force aura, trying to determine whether she was being truthful. They would not detect a lie, because she was, in fact, responsible for Mara's death. She had worked it all out, using the same logic that had once allowed the darkness to control Unu Thule. Since she had been in Haven's space when Mara died, Mara could have been following her instead of Lumaya, which meant that Alima might be the one truly responsible for Mara stumbling across Jason. And of course, that meant Alima was certainly the one who had gotten the hag killed. Simple. It didn't take the Sith long to see that Alima was telling the truth. They deactivated the lightsabers they had ignited when she reached for her data chip, then seemed to regard her with new depths of respect.
"Very well," White Eyes said. "You killed Mara Skywalker. Why did you come here? Are you looking for shelter?"
"Shelter?"
Alima was insulted by the question.
"Do you take us for a coward? Do you think we seek refuge while Jason Solo is out there fighting for the balance?"
White Eyes asked.
"If you don't want shelter, then why did you come?"
"For help and guidance."
The force rolled with dark confusion, and the raspy-voiced woman asked,
"You want guidance?"
"From us?"
White Eyes added.
"Exactly. Without Lumaya there to guide him, the truth is that Jason Solo is stumbling badly. He actually took the Academy hostage."
"So we have heard,"
White Eyes said.
"What does that have to do with us?"
Alima began to understand. They had no intention of actually risking their lives to support Jason. They just wanted to hide here while he did all the work and took all the mortal risks and delivered the galaxy to them on a platter.
Is that how it is?
She demanded.
You create your emperors and just send them out into the galaxy on their own. No wonder all it took to bring Palpatine down was a farm boy and a self-absorbed princess.
There was dead silence for a moment, and even the Force seemed frozen with shock. Finally, White Eyes asked,
You think we train Jason Solo?
Of course. Lumaya said there was a plan.
Alima didn't bother to keep the disdain out of her voice.
Those were her exact words. There is a plan. A plan that will be carried out whether or not I survive.
At last, the White Eyes seemed to glow with comprehension.
Lumaya's plan, not ours. Hers and Vergere's.
Now it was Alima's turn to be surprised.
Vergere was a Sith? You didn't know that?
Asked the raspy-voiced woman.
I thought you were Lumaya's apprentice.
Do you tell your apprentice everything?
Alima countered.
Perhaps not, White Eyes allowed. In any case, Jason Solo is not our problem. Nor do we want him to be.
Which is why you won't be allowed to leave here alive,
the woman added.
You keep saying that, but we'd be dead already if you didn't have more questions.
Despite Alima's bravado, she knew her time was running out.
Whose question is it now?
She asked.
Let's say it is yours,
White Eyes offered. Alima pointed toward the data chip she had given him, which had vanished somewhere inside his cloak.
That message you sent Lumaya. If you wanted nothing to do with her plan, why did you invite her here?
It was sent before she developed her plan,
White Eyes explained.
Our master wanted her to join our organization, but she and her escort were ambushed by the Yuuzhan Vong. Lumaya escaped. Lomi Plo and her apprentice did.
Lomi Plo was one of you?
Alima gasped.
Truly?
How do you know Lomi Plo?
Morto asked, sounding to Alima's experienced ear like a lust-toed lover. He stepped closer, coming up behind her.
What happened to her?
Alima answered without turning around.
Lomi Plo was our, master.
She quickly moved away.
She died at the Battle of Tanupe.
You are lying.
Morto continued to follow her.
Why would she be fighting Killix?
She wasn't, silly.
Alima turned to face him, but terrified he would touch her and mar what little remained of her beauty, she continued to back away.
She was fighting for Gorog. She was our queen.
Morto stopped in his tracks.
She was a bug?
That's no way to talk about her.
If Alima had not been afraid to touch him, she would have force-slapped him so hard his eyes flew from their sockets.
We thought you loved her. Isn't that so?
Morto's feelings for his master are no business of yours,
rasped the woman.
And I thought Lumaya was your master.
Lomi Plo was before Lumaya. We seem to go through masters like males.
Alima eased away from Morto, then turned back to the Sith on the balcony.
You had nothing to do with creating Jason?
White Eyes shook his head.
Our master met Vergere while he was a captive of the Yuuzhan Vong. She liked his vision of one Sith.
But after the first battle of Bilbringi, she escaped the Yuuzhan Vong and met Lumaya,
the woman continued.
And Lumaya convinced her that our master's plan was too slow, that by the time one Sith were ready to act, Skywalker's Jedi would be too strong to defeat.
So they decided to create Jason,
White Eyes finished.
They did the right thing,
Alima insisted.
And if you don't help Jason now, the Jedi will destroy him and the balance will be ruined.
The balance? White Eyes asked. Which balance is that?
You don't know the balance?
Alima couldn't believe that a Sith Master would need to ask such a thing.
Between every user and the Force, there is the balance. Between every Force user and her enemies, there is the balance. We serve the balance by doing to our enemies what they do to us. If we fail, the Force itself will fall.
Enough!
White Eyes raised a black-gloved hand, and Alima found herself choking on her words. He cast an inquiring glance along both sides of the balcony above the courtyard. When they all nodded in response, he turned back to the courtyard and looked past Alima to Morto.
I think our questions have been answered.
Morto's lightsaber sizzled to life. To Alima's surprise, she remained free to act, to reach for her own lightsaber and spin around to defend herself. And she realized the Sith meant her death to be a practice session for Morto. She snatched her weapon off her belt, but instead of igniting it, she backed away and raised it as though asking for permission to speak.
Wait!
Alima had to croak the word, for White Eyes was still using the Force to silence her.
Last question.
The Force hummed with impatience, but the pressure suddenly vanished from Alima's throat.
Very well, White Eyes said. One question.
Thank you.
Alima tucked her lightsaber under her arm and rubbed her throat, then said,
Luke Skywalker will soon discover who killed his wife. Do you really want him to track us here?
The impatience in the Force changed first to misgivings and concern, then to disappointment. White Eyes and the others exchanged a long series of glances, then, without saying anything, seemed to reach the consensus Alima had expected.
Put your lightsaber away, Morto,
the woman rasped. When Morto didn't obey quickly enough, the White Eyes flared in his direction and sent him flying. The trip ended with the sharp crack of his skull against stone, followed by the sound of crashing armor and a lightsaber snapping off. Alima glanced back and saw the Tagorian sitting at the base of a support pillar, one hand pressed to his bloody head.
Thank you, she said. But we were thinking of more help than that.
White Eyes' gaze turned to Alima.
You will stay the night. We may have something for Jason Solo after all.
Kashyyyk.
Flying by instruments because visibility was so poor, Jaina dropped out of the smoke and followed the navigation beacon through a gaping hangar mouth into more smoke. Though she had not seen any flames on her approach, it seemed to her all of Rorororo must have been burning to produce such a pall. A pair of marshalling beacons appeared in the haze, directing her to turn right and slow down. Jaina grimaced and obeyed, realizing that in her haste to catch Luke, she had entered the hangar far too quickly. All around her, vague, blocky forms materialized into stealth X's, fueling sleds, and armament racks. No sooner had Jaina set her craft down than a shaggy crew of Wookiees was swarming over it, refueling and checking weapon status. She disengaged her suit connections and extracted herself from the crash webbing, then popped the canopy and sprang out of the cockpit, landing beside a confused-looking Wookiee holding an access ladder.
Where's Luke Skywalker?
She asked. The Wookiee pointed through the smoke toward the back of the hangar, where Jaina could barely see a squadron of pilots climbing into their stealth X's. She took off at a run, dodging hover sleds and technicians and coughing on the acrid air. She caught up to Luke just as R2, memory enhanced to help fly stealth X's, was being lowered into the droid socket. Jaina had not calmed or reached out to let Luke know she was coming, but he did not seem surprised as he turned to greet her. Hello, Jaina. I hope everything is under control at the Academy. Jaina nodded.
Jag and Zek are looking after things until we can get some more Jedi Knights there. Most of the GAG troopers were pretty appalled at Serpa's orders, and the rest aren't exactly spoiling for a fight, especially after we returned the lightsabers to the Wampas.
Good. Luke seemed distracted. Still, Serpa's battalion isn't all we have to worry about. If Jason is willing to do this... He let the sentence trail off and waved vaguely around them, the gesture taking in all of Kashyyyk.
I understand, but there's something you need to know, and I have to tell you in person.
Jaina looked around the hangar.
Is Ben here? He should hear this too. Luke shook his head. He's supposed to be on his way from Coruscant.
Supposed to be? Jaina asked. Ben is overdue?
Not exactly, Luke said. I sent a message to him after we left Kuat. But I can't tell where he is. Ben is shutting himself off from the Force again. Jaina really didn't like the way Luke was sounding. Your parents left last night, Luke added, as though he thought they might have been a substitute for Ben. They have a plan.
They always have a plan, Jaina said. Uncle Luke, are you feeling all right? You seem kind of, well, distracted.
Luke glanced up into the smoke. We're going after your brother. I don't like doing it.
He's the one who started this, Jaina said. But if you're hesitant because he's your nephew,
I'm not. R2-D2 whistled down from the droid socket, indicating it was time for their flight check. I'll be right there, Luke said. He turned back to Jaina. What did you need to tell me?
Maybe now isn't a good time, Jaina said. It looks like you've got enough on your mind.
I'm the Jedi Grand Master, Jaina, Luke said. I know how to keep my concentration. His tone wasn't exactly sharp, but it was commanding. And Jaina knew that trying to hold back now would only distract him even more.
It's about Alima, she said. She took out a freighter crew at Roku Depot shortly after Mara died.
That's not surprising, Luke said. Roku Depot is on the way to Terrafon, and we know she ended up with Lumaya's ship after I killed her.
Jaina shook her head. This was before your fight.
Luke's expression seemed more puzzled than shocked.
Roku Depot is between Cavan and Terrafon, Jaina prompted. Alima was right there. The timing was right, and she was in a very nasty mood. She killed half a dozen beings for no reason we could figure out.
Luke's brow shot up.
So you think she...
He let the sentence trail off, unable or unwilling to say it aloud. How solid is this?
Well, we do know that Alima likes to use poisons, Jaina said. That's how she killed two of those people on Roku. And Jag said that when he found her cave on Tanupe, it looked like she'd been making them for hunting and self-defense.
Luke nodded and started up the access ladder into his cockpit. It certainly seems to implicate her. Thank you, Jaina. I'm sure you'll bring her to justice.
Jaina scowled. Don't you mean we?
After my mistake with Lumaya? Luke shook his head. It's better for someone else to handle this. Talk to the Council Masters if you need additional resources.
The Masters? Jaina echoed. What aren't you telling me about this mission?
Luke dropped into his cockpit. I haven't told you anything yet, as I recall.
Then it's time to change that.
Jaina grabbed the access ladder and pulled herself up until she was eye to eye with Luke.
I'm not letting you go until I know why you're acting this way.
It's nothing special, Luke said. A standard assault mission. We're going to soften up the Fifth Fleet so the Wookiees have a fighting chance to stop Jason's pyromania.
And?
Luke sighed. And I'm going to use the assault as a diversion to make a run at the Anakin Solo. Loey managed to drop a shadow bomb near the bridge, and we might drive it off with another hit, maybe even take it out. Jaina dropped off the ladder.
I'm coming.
Great, Luke said. Tahiri seems to have disappeared. You can take her place in the Nightblades.
With you?
Jaina, I don't need...
The hell you don't?
Jaina turned back to her own stealth X. Jaina had barely reattached her suit systems to the cockpit before the order came to launch. She closed her canopy, and once the ground chief had given her the okay, engaged her repulsor drives and spun around. The stealth X's were just launching, a long line of black ghosts gliding out the hangar door, arcing up into the Roshiers and vanishing into the smoke. Most of the wing had departed before Jaina felt Luke touch her mind. She opened herself to the Force, expecting to join him in a combat meld. She felt only his outer presence, reluctant and unwelcoming, and even that quickly drew in on itself until she could barely tell it was there. Jaina slid into line behind her uncle, wishing there was some way to comfort him through the Force, but knowing there wasn't. A few minutes later, they were climbing out of the smoke into the blue Kashyyyk sky. It was almost too early to call the battle a battle. The Wookiee fleet was still on the far side of the planet, just getting itself organized. The Fifth Fleet was dead ahead, floating between them and the Anakin Solo's flashing turbo lasers,
a field of white speckles interlaced with the tiny blue filaments of starfighter ion tails. Then Jaina felt it, a pressure building in the Force, a sensation of imminent arrival. Several thousand kilometers to one side of the fleet, crooked snakes of iridescence began to dance between the stars. Immediately, a message scrolled across the primary display, reporting the arrival of a large fleet. "No kidding," Jaina said. "Whose fleet?" "Unknown. Classifying vessels now." Jaina's question was answered an instant later when a volley of green dashes erupted from the new arrivals and blossomed against the shields of the Fifth Fleet. "Bothan," Sneaker answered. "Bothan?" Jaina was incredulous. The Bothans were the last species she would have expected to come rushing to the Wookiee's aid.
"Are you sure?"
"No. Correlation is only 98.87%, Sneaker informed her. "Damage from recent engagement prevents certitude." Jaina scowled inside her helmet. The damage profile suggested the Bothans had broken away from the Battle of Kuat to come to defend Kashyyyk.
"It doesn't make sense," she said to herself. "What are they doing here?"
"Attacking us."
"Not us," Jaina told the droid. "You need to realign your friend or foe identification files. We've sort of changed sides."
The Fifth Fleet began to return fire, focusing Alliance attention on the Bothans and making it even more unlikely that the fleet would notice the Stealth X's coming. By the time the Stealth X's had drawn near enough to worry about being spotted visually, the Fifth Fleet was fully engaged against the Bothans. All too soon, the Fifth Fleet started to spread across Jaina's canopy. Its vessels began to assume identifiable shapes, the wedges of Star Destroyers, the cylinders of heavy frigates, the sleek curves of Mon Calamari cruisers. The Stealth X wing split into six squadrons and angled toward different areas of the fleet. Jaina and Luke fell in with the Nightblades and followed Saba Sebatine toward the Vulnerator, an old Victory-class Star Destroyer that had been in service as long as Jaina's parents. The Vulnerator and its two escort frigates swelled rapidly in the forward canopy, their shields glimmering gold with turbolaser energy. When the vessels did not lose so much as a blaster bolt at the approaching Jedi, Jaina began to think it might have been better to have the Stealth X's simply sneak through the Fifth Fleet's protective shell and swarm the Anakin Solo. Then a chill raced down her spine, and the Nightblades began to scatter. Space exploded into clouds of fiery brilliance in every direction, and Jaina's Stealth X buckled so hard she could not read her displays. Crash webbing bit into her shoulders, and damage alarms began to beep, alerting her to a multitude of problems she had no time to register. She sensed Luke diving to one side and jammed the stick over, following, then breathed a sigh of relief when the starfighter actually responded.
"How bad is it, Sneaker?"
The droid sent a report to the primary display. The way the cockpit was bouncing, it was just jumping lights.
"Can't read it. Are we holding together?"
Another volley of crimson blossoms opened around them, many laced together by flashing lines of cannon bolts. The Vulnerator had anticipated their attack, waiting until the Stealth X's had drawn close enough to spot. Then, and this was the smart part, the part that required discipline only the Alliance Space Navy could instill, the gunners had held their fire until all stations had acquired the target. Luke was weaving through the storm almost effortlessly, slipping away from turbolaser strikes half a second before they blossomed, ducking cannon bolts as though he had a telepathic connection to the gunner's mind. She concentrated on staying behind him, trying to follow the silhouette of his Stealth X as it darted through the fiery curtain surrounding them. Jaina reached out in the Force, hoping to join the nearest combat meld and discover that the situation wasn't so bad, and recoiled from the disapproval Luke sent boiling her way. She quickly drew back in on herself, and thinking he was actually having to hold back so she could keep up, concentrated on staying on his tail. When Luke did not increase the sharpness of his maneuvers and came perilously close to flying them into a fireball, she finally realized that his reason for shunning the combat meld earlier had nothing to do with concealing his pain. Luke was hiding from Jaina. Jaina was the reason the Fifth was so prepared, why they seemed to be expecting the Stealth X attack, even with the distraction provided by the arrival of the Bothan fleet. Jaina had been looking for the Jedi combat meld. Jaina was still contemplating this when the Vulnerator retargeted its batteries and space turned dark again. She checked the tactical display and found the entire Fifth Fleet shifting fire back toward the approaching Bothans. A handful of Star Destroyer symbols were blinking yellow for damaged, but all in all, the Stealth X attack had been a terrible failure. Just how the Masters might plan it if they wanted to minimize Alliance casualties while Luke slipped through to take out Jaina.
That would certainly explain Luke's behavior before launch. Jaina tightened up, coming in so close that she could see R2-D2's dome blinking. Luke seemed to sense what she was doing, or what she was worried about, and gave a little wing waggle. Then he drew in his force presence so tightly that she could no longer find it. She thought at first he was mocking her, but quickly realized he was showing her what to do. She pulled her own presence so close that Jason would have to be sitting in the cockpit to sense her. Luke gave another wing waggle. They left the Fifth Fleet behind, descending toward the flashing beams of turbo laser light that were all they could see of the Anakin Solo. The Anakin Solo itself began to appear a moment later, a hand-sized wedge briefly silhouetted whenever a distant turbolaser strike blossomed in the right place. The flashes of silhouette grew rapidly larger as Jaina and Luke approached, until it became a fixed stain against the stars. Jaina watched in disbelief as it expanded to the size of a bantha, and still the Anakin Solo did not open fire. Unless the visual lookouts were asleep or blind, they had to have noticed the stealth X's streaking toward their vessel by now. Luke must have been thinking the same thing, because he suddenly began to juke and jink so furiously that Jaina could hardly stay on his tail. Jaina didn't even try to match his maneuvers, contenting herself to remain generally behind him in a covering position. The Anakin Solo swelled until all she could see was a mountain of black durasteel, and she began to hope, to believe even, that they had somehow sneaked up on the Star Destroyer. Maybe, just maybe, Luke had been disguising their approach with some force skills she didn't even know existed. And that was when the lock alarms broke out screeching. Jaina's seat slammed into her from behind as a salvo of cannon bolts blew down her rear shields and started chewing through her thin Stealth X armor. There was no need to roll out because she lost control and tumbled toward the Anakin Solo, then ricocheted off its particle shields and began to tumble toward a dark cube that, when she caught glimpses of it, looked perilously like an idle turbo laser turret. Jaina slammed one control pedal to the floor and released the other, jerking the stick back to her belly and hitting the thrusters. The Stealth X accelerated into something that resembled control, and she was relieved to find herself streaking starward instead of into a black expanse of durasteel. "Damage report!" she snapped. The order came by instinct, then also by instinct, the question. "What happened?" She looped into a dive and read Sneaker's response. "Rear shield generators overloaded and destroyed. Number 3 ion engine destroyed. Rear accessory mount destroyed. Damage caused by multiple laser cannon strikes." "I figured that," Jaina said. "Where'd they..." She let the question trail off as the dark plane of the Anakin Solo's hull drifted back into view, and she saw where the attack had come from. Luke was attempting to roll onto the top side of the Star Destroyer, still juking and jinking as he tried to position himself for an attack run on the bridge. A few hundred meters behind him, and closing fast, a second Stealth X was pouring bolts in his direction, angling its fire so Luke could not rise above the Anakin Solo's midline without crossing into a stream of death. "Jason!" "Insufficient data to determine pilot identity," Sneaker informed her. "He knew!" Jaina ignored the droid's message and pointed her nose after the two Stealth X's. "He knew the whole plan!" Jaina's forward canopy erupted into a storm of color as the Anakin Solo's close defense gunners caught sight of her. She opened the throttles wide and held her own triggers down, relying on her forward shields far more than anyone in the Stealth X should, trusting to the Force and her own quick reflexes to keep her shieldless tail in one piece. As her Stealth X sizzled and pinged with cannon hits, Jaina dropped over the hull's edge and slipped in behind her uncle and brother. Jaina locked her sights on Jason and fired. He anticipated and slipped in the opposite direction, and one of her bolts lit up Luke's rear shields. Jason dropped back in and added another 3 hits for good measure, then dodged aside as Jaina fired again. This time, one of her bolts burned through and disappeared into an engine. There was a flash and a puff of smoke. Luke's Stealth X seemed to skid and bounce off the Anakin Solo's shields. Then, to Jaina's utter astonishment, it rolled over Jason's fire and disappeared onto the upper hull. Jaina managed to stitch a line of bolts across Jason's upper shields as he pursued. Then she followed and found herself struggling to keep up as they streaked past the cloaking cone toward the cratered superstructure of the bridge. She pressed her triggers. Again, Jason slipped her fire, and again the bolts only added to Luke's problems. Her brother seemed to anticipate every shot before she took it. "This'll never work," she growled. Jaina reached out to Luke, trying to draw him into a combat meld. and found only Jason's presence, powerful and dark and mocking.
Jason's Stealth X dropped back into her sights. She felt her fingers depressing the triggers, then sensed a dark chuckle in the back of her mind and realized he was goading her. Then she heard Luke's voice, clearly, as though it were coming over a comm speaker.
Do it. Lock him down.
Jaina depressed all four triggers and held them. Jason jinked out of the way, taking a wing hit that sent a laser cannon spinning away. And Jaina found herself looking at the stern of Luke's Stealth X, watching in relief as it veered away from her line of cannon bolts. Then, Luke's damaged engine erupted in flames. The Stealth X seemed to skid, veering back into Jaina's line of fire, and a blast of surprise and panic shot through the force. She released the triggers instantly, but a quartet of bolts was already leaping from the tips of her cannons. They caught Luke dead in the stern, chewing through the damaged armor in a flaming eye blink. The force boiled with anguish, and then Jaina was flying through a fireball that had once been a starfighter. She pulled up more by instinct than because she wanted to avoid crashing. Had there been time to think about it, she might well have flown her battered Stealth X straight into the looming mass of the Anakin Solo's bridge. Because this was one mission from which she truly did not want to return. Luke Skywalker was dead, and Jaina had shot him down.
Hapes, Fountain Palace, Royal Hangar.
Hidden in the smile of an enormous cliff sculpture of a strikingly beautiful Hapen queen, the secret entrance to the Royal Hangar was, like everything associated with the Fountain Palace, a testament to the wealth and power of the Hapen Consortium. It was also designed to accommodate the sleek little skiffs and sport catches that the messengers or secret lovers might fly, not working transports like the Millennium Falcon. As they started down the access tunnel, Han eyed the long line of crystal lumineers hanging from the ceiling and hoped C-3PO had been right about their clearances. It wouldn't be like Tennel Ka to hold it against him if he hit something, but it wouldn't make it any easier to convince her that Jason had to be stopped, either. In the co-pilot's seat, Leia suddenly gasped, then followed it up with a couple of sharp, short breaths. Han's eyes dropped to the maneuvering display.
What'd I hit?
As far as he could tell, he still had at least 10 centimeters clearance on all sides.
I didn't feel anything.
I don't believe you've hit anything yet, Captain Solo.
You don't have to sound so disappointed.
Han returned his gaze to the forward viewport and aligned the Falcon's loading mandibles squarely under the last ceiling lumineer. Once the Falcon had finally left the access tunnel and entered the vast opulence of the Queen Mother's hangar, he glanced over to see why Leia still hadn't answered him. She was sitting forward in her seat, leaning into her crash webbing, her hand to her mouth. Her eyes were fixed out the forward viewport and focused somewhere, well beyond, and she had the look. Han's heart dropped. Everything dropped, and as the Falcon swung toward the orange marshalling lights, he was not conscious of moving the yoke in that direction.
Oh. Oh, he gasped. Not again. Not Jaina.
No. Jaina's okay.
Leia was shaking her head, but she had the look of someone who had just watched a star explode.
Well, sort of. I don't know.
You don't know?
Han demanded. Han managed to guide the Falcon into its berth and drop her onto her landing skids, then took a few deep breaths, trying one of those Jedi calming techniques Leia had told him about to keep himself under control.
Okay,
he said.
What do you mean, sort of? Either you feel her alive or you don't.
Leia finally seemed to understand the panic she was causing and reached over, clasping his hand.
She's okay. I mean, she will be. I think she's upset because she sensed the same thing I just did. Maybe she even saw it.
Saw what?
Leia squeezed his hand.
Luke.
That was as far as she made it before she broke down croaking and sobbing. And that was all Han needed her to say. Luke was dead. It did not seem fundamentally possible, as though by some natural law the galaxy had to end before Luke did. But he knew that was what Leia meant.
You're kidding.
Han couldn't think of anything else to say.
You've got to be kidding.
Leia shook her head.
I felt this surprise then, this anguish, and Luke was just gone.
They sat in their seats, Leia letting her tears flow free and Han too stunned to do more than hold her hand for who knew how long. After a time, a tentative rap echoed through the hull, coming from the still-closed boarding ramp.
"Perhaps I should answer that. Hangar security masters can be quite unforgiving about suspicious behavior these days."
"Thanks, 3PO," Han said. "Let him know we've just received some bad news. We'll need a while to pull ourselves together."
"No," Leia began to dab her eyes dry. "Tell them we'll be out in a moment."
"Of course, Princess Leia."
C-3PO started to turn away, then paused.
"And my condolences regarding Master Luke. Could you sense whether R2 was with him?"
Leia shook her head.
"I'm sorry, 3PO, I couldn't tell."
"Yes, well, if Master Luke found it necessary to die, I'm sure R2 would have wanted to be with him."
Another rap echoed through the hull, this one more forceful, and C-3PO started aft. Leia unbuckled her crash webbing and stood, then checked her face in the canopy reflection.
"I'll just have to do this with puffy eyes. Let's go."
"Are you sure you're up to it?" Han asked. "Tenel Ka's almost family. She'll understand if you need a little time to..."
"Thanks, Han, but we don't have time."
She squeezed his arm. "Not while Kashyyyk burns." She started aft, pulling Han along.